From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. An important victory for now is Governor Gavin Newsom's characterization of the U.S. Supreme Court decision today regarding the DACA program. The 5-4 ruling upholds the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. That decision was announced early this morning. The governor added, "We need a permanent solution for undocumented Californians," and acknowledged that a pathway to citizenship is not enough. The first tweet from President Trump read, "These horrible and politically charged decisions coming out of the Supreme Court are shotgun blasts into the face of people that are proud to call themselves Republicans or conservatives." And Maria Hinojosa, host and executive producer of Latino USA, tweeted, "I hate to be a buzzkill, but I want to remind people that young people who are part of DACA have been deported ever since it was started. It is not at all a perfect solution. Only real massive immigration reform would do that, but this is a win for all of those activists." So you can find more reaction from law professors Leslie Jacobs and the dean of the UC Davis Law School, Dean Kevin R. Johnson, from our early start to Insight. We began actually about 10 minutes ago. Their comments and this entire hour will be posted later online at capradio.org/insight. For now, let's get to more reaction. On the phone is the executive director of the UC Immigrant Legal Services Center, Maria Blanco. Hi, Maria. Glad to have you back on Insight.
Yes, thank you. Glad to be here.
So give me your words for this decision and some of your analysis on behalf of the DACA recipients you work with day in, day out.
Well, first of all, everyone, my phone has been, you know, as you can imagine, email and phone blowing up. And the very first feeling of many of these students that we work with that are DACA recipients is a tremendous sense of relief. It's hard to overemphasize the stress that people have been under ever since the administration rescinded DACA and while people were waiting for this decision. So there's a tremendous sense of relief. And for many of them, it means that in the immediate future, they can continue to work, to go to school, to not fear deportation. So it's very significant, the decision for people, you know, to be able to continue to function. My reaction to the, having read carefully now the opinion that came out this morning, is that to me the most important part, besides the court saying that the way the rescission occurred was not done properly, is language that the court has in the majority opinion talking about how the administration failed to address the tremendous reliance, not just that the young people had on DACA, but that institutions like the university or large employers and small employers had on having DACA recipients among its students, among their employees. And so that discussion about the importance of the reliance, I think, is very significant. It cites statistics, numbers, taxes that people pay that are DACA recipients. So I was very, they don't reach a conclusion about the legality of DACA, but they make a very strong argument that this was overlooked by the administration when it made a very quick and not well-reasoned decision to rescind DACA.
Maria, in fact, Justice Clarence Thomas, in his dissent on this opinion, wrote, "Today's decision must be recognized for what it is, an effort to avoid a politically controversial but legally correct decision." So then the question becomes, where you think this will go next? Because the president could make another attempt in a different legal effort to rescind the program. Congress could decide to take it up, or we're in the midst of the ramp to an election. It could just sit for a while. What's your expectation?
Yes, exactly. You've addressed all the things that folks are thinking about. I mean, the decision basically says, bottom line, DHS now has to consider the problem anew, is their language. So they can't just tweak it. They have to make a brand new decision, explain, you know, to rescind DACA, and they have to do it, you know, taking into account all the considerations that the court has outlined they should have considered. And that could take a while. They, you know, the court is pretty strong in saying they can't just tweak this and do a, what they call a post hoc rationalization. They have to literally issue a new decision with a new basis for the decision. So if that happens, it has to happen, I would think, before an election. Or, you know, the administration could decide not to do anything and just leave things as is, as they are. But I think that's a risky proposition for the administration to not act on this before the decision, because the court literally sends it back to DHS and says, now you have to do something about this.
All right, Maria, I'm going to jump in there and ask you to say something to all the students, all the families who are listening and concerned about whatever relief / limbo goes on. Mm-hmm. If one of them was sitting in your office across from
which
you.
Which I'm sure they will be.
They're calling you to do it by phone right now or on a Zoom call pretty soon. What do you say to them right now?
I say it's really important to continue to lead your life the way you were before this rescission. Stay in school. I think there's a lot of hope right now. I am hopeful that Congress will act in a positive way. We have an election coming up, potentially a new administration that will reissue not just a DACA policy, but we may get a DREAM Act, which is much more permanent. And so I think we are in a very good position right now, and people should feel protected and continue to lead their lives.
All right. I so appreciate your time today. It's great to be able to get the reaction from you, and take care during these times are so layered and complicated. I appreciate it, Maria.
Yes. All right.
It's bye-bye. Executive Director of the UC Immigrant Legal Services Center, Maria Blanco. We're going to shift gears now, although news about the Supreme Court's DACA ruling will continue throughout the day on CAP Radio and via NPR. But 47 states tomorrow will observe June 19th as a paid holiday. You might know that Governor Andrew Cuomo added New York to the list yesterday. In California, Juneteenth, as it's called, has been observed as a holiday on the third Saturday in every June since 2003. Then Governor Gray Davis signed the legislation into law. Nevada's Governor Steve Sisolak last year proclaimed June 19th to be Juneteenth Independence Day in Nevada. The Sacramento Kings this week made it an annual paid company holiday, which is happening at many companies across the country. CAP Radio, in fact, made the same decision as of yesterday. So let's start this conversation with a bit of a history lesson about this date. Joining us now by phone is author and Sac State History Professor, Dr. Antonio Bly. And Dr. Bly, thanks so much for joining us on Insight.
Thank you for having me.
I'm going to set the stage by saying that back in time, Congress had passed the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery on January 31st, 1865. The Civil War began to end on April 9th of that year. Now take us to what happened in June.
What happened in June happened on Galveston Island, and it was a remarkable event, largely because news traveled slowly in those days. And so on June 19th, Major General Granger went to Galveston Island and informed the slaves there that they were free. And that's one of the reasons that we celebrate Juneteenth today. Tomorrow. And so it is a celebration of freedom. It is a celebration of America. And preparing for this talk, I think I would like to stress that latter part, because I think far too often Juneteenth is associated primarily with African Americans, and I think it's much more than that.
So expand on that.
Well, how do you begin to tell the story of America? African Americans came here in 1619. We are still debating whether or not they were slaves or they were servants or a combination of both. I would argue they were a little bit of both things. And then in 1776, it jumped just a little bit. The British colonists decided that they no longer wanted the tyranny of England and declared themselves free and independent. But that independence had very little to do with thousands of African Americans that were held as slaves. And not until 1865 do we see the fruition of the American promise. The American promise being that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. African Americans were embraced into that dream, into that promise. And so for many of us, Juneteenth is a second Independence Day. I would take it one step further and say it has as much prominence in the American experience as July 4th, which is right around the corner, largely because it is on that particular day that we say, yes, all men are created equal. And in light of recent events, which I hope we get into, it is a day of celebration, a day of remembrance of our ancestors, but also the debt that is owed to people of African descent.
I want to quickly address the fact that most of us were taught in school that the Emancipation Proclamation ended slavery. And if there was one of those highlighted boxes on the page, you know, the kind of side tangent little story about Juneteenth, I honestly don't remember it. Do you know if Juneteenth was part of curriculum or teaching in places other than perhaps Texas?
It was where I am from. I'm originally from Virginia. Tidewater area. We celebrated Juneteenth. As I recall, we celebrated in middle school and in high school, and both within the community and within the school system. And so that's been my experience. But I know that for others, Juneteenth is something that's foreign, something that they did not know about. And so it kind of evolved when and where African Americans migrated to, and depending on the times, you will discover whether or not we celebrated. But my community, which was largely an integrated community in Norfolk, Virginia, we celebrated it for all of my life.
In fact, it is said to be the oldest African American observed holiday. But here we are, Dr. Bly, in 2020, and we are in another powerful moment in this country's civil rights revolution. So bring us up to the present. What does Juneteenth mean this year and right now?
This year, right now, Juneteenth means a celebration of what it means to be an American. In light of the recent DACA decision, in light of the recent LGBT decision, what better time to celebrate than this moment, tomorrow, Juneteenth, because with African Americans go the progress of this nation. And I think that we should all be outside having cookouts to some extent, doing it safely, of course, eating red velvet cake, having red soda, barbecue, to remember the best part of our experience in the country. Hmm. So for me, Juneteenth is that day. Really, it's my 4th of July.
Well, I do want to note your book, which is getting such strong and supportive reviews. It's titled Escaping Bondage. And in this, you transcribed, collected, and have published newspaper notices about fugitive slaves, or I guess
yes.
The word fugitive should be in quotes there. But say a bit more about this book, because it might have been one thing to read it a year ago or 6 months ago. It comes in a totally different context now.
Yes, that book grew out of my doctoral thesis, which was looking at slave education in Colonial Virginia. I spent a year or two in the Library of Congress reading newspapers, and what I found was a plethora of advertisements for runaway slaves. And at some point in the process, I decided that I should publish these things because far too often these things are not known to the public, especially in New England. And so with that project completed, it led me to the next project, which was indentured servants, which is another one of those interesting subjects that most people don't think about, runaway servants. And so I did that book, and I'm currently working on, I guess, the third book in the trilogy, which is about runaway Native Americans. Hmm. And, I guess I'm the runaway America man now. not by choice, but it's just how it happens.
Well, I have to call you the expert by phone because we're still not able to do these interviews in person. But it would really be great to be able to do that at some point, maybe for your third book, okay?
Yes, yes. As a matter of fact, I look forward to the opportunity. Maybe we can do the Zoom or the Skype.
We have options.
You in the studio.
We have options. Thank you so much for the history lesson and some understanding and appreciation of this day tomorrow that will be powerful across the country and to some extent around the world. Thanks again, Dr. Bly.
Thank you for having me, and I would like to encourage your audience to get out there in your backyards and celebrate Juneteenth. It's an American holiday. It's not just an African-American holiday. It's a holiday for all of us. It's a holiday for freedom, liberty, democracy, justice. And in the curious times that we're living in, we need an occasion to celebrate those aspects of our life that I think represent America the best.
That's Dr. Antonio Bly. He is a professor of history at Sac State. His highly regarded book that I first mentioned is Escaping Bondage. Now joining us by phone is Dr. Greg Downs from UC Davis. And we're going to talk a bit in more detail about these Juneteenth celebrations. Hi, Dr. Downs. Thanks for your time today.
Hi, Dan. Oh, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed your previous segment.
So back in 1865, Texas started the party, I guess, but California has had quite a tradition of continuing it. Will you add that piece to the history lesson, California's focus on Juneteenth?
So I think, you know, that the, there are two pieces, to capture, one of which is why Juneteenth and what are the Texas roots of it. As Dr. Skye said, he celebrated it in Virginia and it was celebrated in some other places. But California has long been a secondary place where Juneteenth has been widely celebrated. And the answer for that lies in 20th century history and the migration of African Americans into Northern and Southern California, especially in the decades after the 19-teens. And in the East Bay area, you know, especially around the wartime effort in the 1940s. And so, you know, many, not all, of the Juneteenth celebrations in California that I'm aware of, though I'm no expert on that, have their roots in these communities of Afro-Texans who move out to California and bring this strong regional tradition with them, that you can see that regional tradition in many forms of African-American life in California, in foodways and other forms of culture, and also in the power of Juneteenth.
I'll note that you're a public historian and you co-wrote the National Park Service's theme study on Reconstruction. So you have studied the political and cultural history in the 19th and 20th centuries. These celebrations, will you tell me what the focus has tended to be? Dr. Bly talked about the food and the gathering together, probably storytelling. I've heard that education is a focus of the celebrations. You know, just like we talk about 4th of July being fireworks and barbecues, what's the tradition of Juneteenth?
Well, I would, you know, as in many of these kind of, gatherings and celebrations, there's going to be lots of different ways that different communities do it. So I don't want to speak with too broad of a brush. But from the beginning, in the very earliest celebrations in places, in Austin in 1867, in 1866, in Austin and in Houston, you start to see some things that do, I think, create common threads, and in many ways that reemphasize the points that Dr. Skaya ably made, that the most famous ones that I'm aware of are at Houston's Park, which is now called Emancipation Park, very aptly. And from the beginning, they combined this sense of a, specific African-American pride with an American pride in the way that Dr. Skye emphasized, so that we see a kind of patriotic songs, flags. This is in late 19th century celebrations, parading in uniform, celebration of African-American service in the Civil War. Defending and celebrating first the political gains of Reconstruction that happened in Texas, a few years after Juneteenth, and that helped shape, the early 1870s in Texas. And then a defense of the memory of those gains, later in the 19th century as the Jim Crow and segregation, overthrew Reconstruction in Texas and in the rest of the South. And as white school systems and as cultural production, novels, and later films worked to discredit Reconstruction, that Juneteenth was often a place for a celebration of those leaders, of those movements, of the gains that had been made, and a celebration, that had its origin in people who had fought for their freedom, taken uniform, and then gone directly into the political fight to defend the rights that they claimed in their freedom and to defend their political rights and political power and to sustain the memory of that in a period where that was overthrown. I think over the 20th century, you can see, many different variations of that in different places. And of course, people always bring to the festival their interest in music and food and celebration and family gatherings. And also these callbacks, as Dr. Skaya said, to the roots of the history.
So I didn't have a chance to ask Dr. Bly about this possibly becoming a federal holiday, why it hasn't, or what it would mean to put that formally in place right now. But I'm interested in your thoughts about that as well. With almost all states having adopted it, what would the difference mean if it became a federal holiday, other than perhaps different government institutions being closed on June 19th?
Well, I think two things, one of which is I think we should recognize that there is some complexity in that. Dr. Bly talked about celebrating that in Tidewater, Virginia, which is very interesting to me. But there are other very powerful regional celebrations, some of which make claims to be older than Juneteenth. Watch Night has a case to be the longest lasting celebration of emancipation, centered in coastal South Carolina and in the regions where people from coastal Carolina and the islands off of Carolinas and Georgias moved to, especially New York and Philadelphia. And that commemorates the wait for the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1, 1863. Though it's not always Watch Night remains practiced and celebrated, it's not always tied back to that, though it is in areas around Beaufort. And in some places have enduring celebrations of a earlier African-American holiday, which was West Indian Emancipation Day, which was celebrated across African-American communities in the North in the late 1830s into the Civil War. And some of those continued those celebrations. As well, there are celebrations in Western Kentucky into Tennessee of the 8th of August, which seems to have its root in a proclamation on August 8, 1863 of emancipation in Tennessee. So there are a range of different regional celebrations of emancipation, some of which were tied into Memorial Day, which was, one argument says that it was originally conceived of by African Americans in Charleston as a celebration of emancipation and took on a different valence over time. So I do think it's worth making sure that in people's dawning awareness of Juneteenth, they don't lose track that there are also different regional moments of celebrating emancipation, which makes sense when you think of communities that have different moments of emancipation. If we think of emancipation as a process, it makes sense that it would be celebrated differently by people who are descendants of coastal South Carolinians or Middle Tennesseans or Texans or West Indians or African Americans, and we're celebrating West Indian emancipation. So I do think we have to figure out how to resolve that issue. And I also think we would also need to make sure that in doing so, we explain what Juneteenth is about. And so that in a way that really centers, that it captures the difficulty of ending slavery, the work that it took of enslaved people, but also of governmental policies to make freedom real, and the overthrow of that effort. As a sort of, to me, what would be powerful about it is as a way to celebrate emancipation and Reconstruction. You know, which is the most forgotten period of U.S. history. Until 2017, there were many hundreds of park sites devoted to the Civil War, zero to Reconstruction. That changed by President Obama in the Beaufort, South Carolina area in January 2017. And there remains a silence about those questions. Why did emancipation take so long? And why did some of its gains prove to be, some of them prove to be ephemeral? And if we can make Juneteenth a holiday that allowed people to celebrate and also to contemplate that, I think it'd be a very powerful way of recentering these questions that are at the center of our questions today. Why does a country that has had these moments continue to struggle with such a deep racial injustice?
I think you and Dr. Bly answered a lot of questions today that have come up. I thank you for your time, and I'll note that it's actually Hawaii, North Dakota, and South Dakota that are the only states right now that don't either have Juneteenth as a state holiday or a day of observance, as California does on the third Saturday of every June. So, Dr. Downs, thank you so much. I look forward to more of these conversations and appreciate your collaboration in this history lesson with Dr. Bly today. Thank you.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
That's UC Davis Professor Dr. Greg Downs. And some banks are going to be closed early tomorrow. Some businesses and government offices will be closed. So if you're headed somewhere for an appointment or planning to take care of an errand, it's wise to call ahead, because some of this decision making has just evolved, as I said, within this last week. Up next, we're switching gears again. We're going to talk a little bit of school news. The Natomas Unified School District is ready to restart sports for students. I'll talk with Superintendent Chris Evans next. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio.